Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
It's been 12 months since residents of the Blue Mountains were bracing themselves for the catastrophic bushfires that were to incinerate almost 200 homes, leaving 700 without anything to their name except perhaps the clothes on their back. Then, adding further pain to the enormous personal losses of the region, local economies for the rest of the area were devastated as tourism floundered. 1 year on, the rebuilding effort is in full swing, with Blue Mountains Council processing more than 150 new development applications. Many more are in the pipeline, but our first guest today tells us there are many who are still unsure as to whether they wish to return after losing everything. Blue Mountains Mayor Mark Greenhill literally endured a baptism of fire as he helped guide his community through the terrors of a firestorm. In welcoming Mark to Open House, we begin with the day fire erupted in the mountains.
I'd been mayor of the Blue Mountains for a month. I was a long-term councillor and had been deputy mayor, but I'd been in the role a month. I was advised by fire authorities what was happening, and immediately I was in a position where I was dealing with media by the hundreds.
Yeah.
And also trying to comfort my community. I started the event at fire control, monitoring what was happening, and then decided my place was with the people affected. So I immediately went to the evacuation centre, and there followed days and days of comforting those who'd lost everything, and setting up a mayoral relief fund and raising a few million dollars for that to support them. And being a volunteer firefighter myself, I also had to attend to that duty. So I was both mayor and firefighter. And although I didn't do as much firefighting as others, only one 12-hour shift, it allowed me to observe close hand the bravery of those men and women who defended my community.
Where did you find strength at a time when so many people were looking to you for it?
I'm a person of faith. I don't proselytise. I don't say everyone, you know, can only find inner strength when they have faith, but everyone is different and find it in a different way. I look to my faith to help me get through what was a very challenging time. But also, what I did was I focused on the people themselves and thought, Mark, this isn't about you, this is about them. You have to be there for them in this time. The worst part was on the actual day as I was in Firecom, but the fires hit Winmalee, and a senior firefighter turned to me and said, look, we're looking at anything up to 200 houses gone here, Mark. In Victoria, they lost a person for every 12 houses burnt, so you need to prepare yourself and do the mathematics. And at that moment, I was confronted with the possibility, indeed, it seemed at the time, likelihood that I'd be dealing with the loss of members of our community. I thank God that that wasn't so, but there was a moment there where, you know, I sort of thought, gosh, you know, I can't do this. But there's not a second mayor, and you know, there's only one. And I looked to my faith, the message that I felt I took from that was that, you know, I had to just put aside my own fears about my own capacity and walk in the shoes of others. So that's what I did.
As the flames started to abate further on down the track, and perhaps as people started to step out of shock and into the loss that comes after a fire like this devastates a community, how daunting did that next phase feel when so many had to start with so little?
Well, we set up a mayoral relief fund and immediately set about raising money, and donations from the community were just wonderful, because we knew the task of rebuilding would be huge. To give you a sense of scale, roughly in round figures, 200 homes destroyed, a further 100 damaged beyond habitation, significantly damaged. So really 300 homes. You're looking at about 750 people displaced, 750. The government, started the recovery process, and then we as a council took it over. So what we did was we went to the community and we set up a committee that was actually made up in part of people affected by the fires and people managing the aftermath. And we said to them, you be our eyes and ears. You've been affected. Some of you have lost homes. Others of you are providing relief. You be our eyes and ears, and you tell us how this recovery process needs to be run. We had to also realise that not everyone's recovery would be the same, that everyone would recover differently and at different times, and recognise all of that. And in so doing, we put together a recovery process that I think was honest. We said to the people at the time, look, we're just a council. Normally, governments run recovery processes, not little councils. So we will do the best we can. It won't be perfect. We'll make mistakes, but we'll try to rectify them when we do. The one promise we make is that we will try and we will be there. I guess it's two promises. A, we will try our best, and B, we will be there every step of the way. And recognising that everyone's recovery is different, you know, when you need us, we will be there for you. And we based our recovery on compassion. We decided at the beginning that compassion would be our catch cry and compassion would be the basis of our recovery.
What is the air this time of the year where we're conflicted between relief that we're still here and we still have friends and family and a place to live, although it may be temporary, versus what we lost 1 year ago today?
Look, it differs for different people. I went and visited people on the weekend who were rebuilding. Some were really pleased that they were rebuilding. Other people would say to me, look, we're rebuilding, but this isn't the house we lost and we're not sure that this is home, and you know, we don't know that we'll even ever move into it. There are others who've moved out of the area. And we say that everyone's recovery, while different, is okay. Even for those, and that's just it, it's all okay. It's all okay. There's nothing wrong with recovering in whatever way you need to recover. And even those people who've left the Blue Mountains say, we'll forever be Blue Mountains. We'll, you know, forever hold them within our hearts. So I guess the one consistent thing coming out of the recovery is just the way the community's hung together. You know, we're in each other's lives, we're in each other's homes, we're checking on each other. You know, if you say to a person that lives in my community, where do you come from? They're not likely to say Sydney or New South Wales. I say to you, I come from the Blue Mountains. Yeah. There's a real sense of place. And that, if anything, has been enhanced greatly since the fires. And it's not a cliche, it's a truth. There's a lot of love up there in the Blue Mountains for each other. And it's given me a lot of faith in humanity.
Mark, is there an image or a story that stands out in your mind a year after the fires that reminds you to keep looking forward, to keep working?
There's probably a few stories. There's the bloke in the ute. Some guy that drove around on the day putting people in his ute and evacuating them. We don't know who he is. But I guess he doesn't really mind. Whether it's the preschool teachers who thought that the preschool was going to catch fire and were prepared to lay over the tops of the children in the hope that one would survive. Or whether it's the firemen who saved them. Really, it's the plethora of stories of bravery that come from that day that say to me that I, as mayor, have to, in their name, do this job the best that I can. And probably, you know, when the recovery's over, be prepared to kind of actually hand the mayoralty to someone else, because I think although it wasn't planned when I took up the role, I'll be at a point when it's finished of saying, look, that's why I was there, and I'm too too sort of exhausted intellectually to take this mayoralty into some other space. But it's done in their name. Yeah. It's done in the name of those stories. Their bravery deserves for it to be done properly, and that's what gets me up every morning.
Mark, yours is a region that relies heavily on tourism, of course. I suspect there's an invitation that you'd like to throw out to the rest of Australia.
Look, tourism took a hit during the fires. We lost hundreds of jobs directly and millions of dollars from our economy, and for no real reason, because the tourism areas weren't affected by the fires. And so we've been on a campaign since of saying, hey, look, We're open for business. We're unaffected in the tourist zones by the fires. We want you here. Please come here. Please be here. Please come and visit. And actually, in doing so, you'll help us recover. So my message to your listeners is this. If you want to escape the balmy summer heat, come up to the Blue Mountains where the best coffee in the world is served and the temperature is better and less humid than it is down in Sydney. And in so doing, not only will you have a wonderful weekend, because of course you should stay the night at one of our many lovely hotels, but you'll help us recover. So it's a symbiotic event.
Mayor Mark Greenhill, it's been a pleasure catching up with you. Thank you so much for your leadership and for your time on Open House Around Australia. Have a great day.
My pleasure. Cheers.
Winmalee residents Peter and Eartha O'Dell had a busy day planned the day the fire came to Winmalee. Eartha was in Sydney preparing for a surgery for their daughter Mia, and their son Ty was being cared for by a neighbour, while Peter was at the wheel of a local bus.
Well, initially it was like any other day. I worked for a community transport group in the Blue Mountains, and I had picked up a whole bunch of people to take to our Winmalee shopping centre, and I dropped them and had actually been at home in the house for lunch. I left there about 1 o'clock and then went and picked up the people I had and took them home, which was all over the mountains. And then I got to the office at 3 o'clock, and I walked in, and my boss, about 3 o'clock, and my boss said, you know, there's fire in Winmalee, and she said, "Do I think you'll be okay? It's in such and such a road, Lynch Road." And I said, "Well, actually, that's very close." So I immediately left, and I prayed, and I said, "Lord, if you can save our house if you want to, but if you can't, please get the glory."
Eartha, you were much farther away still from your home that day, weren't you?
Yes, I'd left about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I had gone to Westmead Children's Hospital with my daughter to sign for the pre-op brain operation. I had been there all day. It took a lot longer than I thought. And I had left my little boy with a neighbour in the street. And as I was driving home, I did see a little bit of smoke, but I wasn't too worried because there was fires at Lithgow, etc.
Yeah.
But as I came into Valley Heights, which is the suburb east of Springwood, I saw a fire, which I knew was close to Yellow Rock or Winmalee, and it was new, it was like a fresh fire. Once I got to Hawkesbury Road and decided to do a UE, and I just picked a lady that I knew was very kind. I'd met her for about half an hour once.
Wow.
And they were terribly, terribly kind. And we set up camp there until we got our little boy back at 8:30 that night. And then we all walked out of Springwood, Ty on Peter's shoulders and one little plastic bag with jumpers someone gave us. It was freezing. I just remember how cold it was, cold and windy. There was just chaos everywhere. The roads were blocked. There was police. And most of the, I suppose, the fire engines had got through by then, but it was all just started to be recovery mode. People were yelling out to us from cars, seeing if everyone was okay. And yeah, it was just very surreal.
Sadly, yours was one of almost 200 family homes incinerated that day, but you committed the entire family to going back and seeing the damage for yourself. Why?
We heard, by about 3 o'clock on the Thursday afternoon, we were pretty sure we'd lost the house completely. But you still want to just see it. It's some sort of closure, if you like, or step in the reality, I guess, that we wanted to go back. We did wait, Dwayne, a couple of days before we went up there, but we wanted to, as a family, go up and see it. That was important to us.
We chose to park at the top of our street and walk down. We actually walked through the whole of our street as a lap of honour, I suppose. It didn't do it justice. Just driving round nicely, we had to walk past all our neighbours and friends, and it was pretty horrific. There's just suburban houses at the top of the street that went that you couldn't believe, and that was a massive shock, seeing six houses in a row wiped out and people. Well, Pete and I lived there for 22 years, so it was a big shock.
Yeah.
When we got to our house, someone had told us it was flat, and I didn't really understand what they meant. I thought, it's not a hurricane or anything. But it was. It was flat and black. and grey. And my daughter said, there's no colour. Where's all the colour gone? And she had a rainbow room, really, and we had colour everywhere. There was no colour. And just you could tell which room was which, but it was terribly confusing to your senses to see it like that.
Peter, you and your family have decided not to return to Winmalee and rebuild your life outside of the area. You described off-air the last 12 months as being a bit of a blur. Could you fill that out for us a little?
Look, you know, I think a bit of a blur is a good description in many ways. It's been immensely busy for us. We've had to rebuild or reconnect with, you know, just normal day things like gas and all that sort of stuff. The things you lose in a fire, we lost everything. So there's no paperwork that we had. There's nothing. All I had and all Earth I had was what we went out with in our cars, you know. So we've had to put together all that, and Eartha, to her credit, has been just wonderful in doing the majority of that. We've experienced immense and overwhelming kindness and generosity from many, many, many people. Our church, Hawkesbury Valley Baptist, has been wonderful. Our friends there have been wonderful. People we don't even know have been wonderful. You know, and it's been overwhelming. In that regard, that's been incredible. But we did this journey with God, and you know, we've had lots of opportunity to speak of His goodness and strength. And the verse that came through all the time for me was Psalm 46: God is our refuge and strength, never present help in trouble. So yeah, it's been amazing 12 months.
Peter, you handed over your family home to the Lord on the way back that afternoon.
Yes.
Have you ever questioned, even in the quietest of moments, why He took it?
No, I haven't, to be honest with you, Dwayne. Something I've learned over the last 12 months with our walk with the Lord is that He's sovereign, and sometimes we ask a question, why do things happen? Why does God allow these things to happen? But I think I've learned that it's not so much the question of why it happens that we should be asking. It is more important that we accept the journey that He takes us on, and that we walk with Him in that journey. The way the Lord has blessed us and provided for us has been incredible. And we just have experienced His overwhelming strength and comfort throughout the whole time and provision. Yeah. So, no, I haven't questioned why He took the house. But, you know, we try to hang on to things pretty loosely. Just if I can just share this, a week before the fire hit, I did a class at my church for young kids, and we did talk about treasure being in heaven and not on earth. And a week later, I really appreciated that. It's our treasure as Christians is in heaven, not on this earth. There are things we value and things that we love and appreciate, and Eartha and I and the kids do miss things that we treasured from the home, but our real treasure is in heaven, and that's a really comforting for us, I'm sure of it.
There is much to praise God for. Peter and Eartha O'Dell, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Dwayne.
Thank you, Dwayne.
Catherine Hubbard was napping after a late night shift as the fires charged toward her Winmalee home. She was woken by her boss calling to ask if she was okay.
I looked out the backyard where my bedroom is upstairs, and there was like a fireball just exploded on the ground and up a tree and all around, and smoke just billowing from the right-hand side of my house at that stage. It was right on my house then or not, I wasn't sure, but I had a bird and a cat photos I wanted to retrieve, and I just picked up the photos and thought, right, and she told me to get my birth certificates, and I was shaking so badly that I couldn't even manage to get them out of the filing cabinet. Then I threw the photos down and grabbed the animals. I had the lorikeet and pulled him out of his cage and the cat and run to the car, threw them in the car, drove as fast as I could around the loop of the street that I live in. I couldn't get out. The smoke was so thick, the sun had been blocked out.
It's a terrifying picture, isn't it? We begin our conversation with Catherine on her last 12 months.
Let's just say it's been a rocky road. It's been wonderful in some ways and really exciting in others, but there's also been like fallout and things like that.
Catherine, after the television crews leave town and the world falls back into its own rhythm, what were the moments that surprised you most?
I think the thing that caught me off guard the most was really the generosity and outreach from people that were pretty much strangers to me and the family. Also, the community at large, like the children's school, was incredibly supportive to my children. That was the one constant that they did have. They provided counselling and support in so many ways. I was really blessed by that. The other thing was obviously finding a home and relocating from where we were staying. That was a massive change and a massive challenge, considering there were so many other people lining up and needing homes that were quite desperate too, and that was pretty sad to see.
There must be an awful conflict, Catherine, lining up for accommodation, welfare, clothing, with your family in tow, prioritising their needs, when you look around and see so many other families just like yours in need of the same stuff.
You know, initially, at first, it was, because there was some reactions. Just say there was families already lined up and they saw us coming. It wasn't necessarily a very pleasant experience.
No.
But, you know, like, because we have a Christian faith, we you know, our provision is not just what's happening right now. There is a bigger picture, and we come from the position of the bigger picture. And in our hearts, in all honesty, there was a family standing there quite distressed, and we went and had a look at the house, and, you know, I just walked past and said, you know, we're not going to go for this house. Just to put them at ease. So we probably still came at putting others first in spite of it, because we knew that provision would come one way or another.
Catherine, in the months to follow, as life returns to some kind of rhythm and you start to move past the phase of immediately just being grateful that somebody in your case bothered to ring and wake you up as the fire was starting to burn your own veranda and then your house down. And then you start to realise that you don't have anything. You are left with nothing. How do you balance the relief versus the loss?
Okay, at the time, I don't think we really... I didn't really have time to dwell on that at the time. It was more about the immediate needs. It was as things started to settle down and we got into our own, we got our new house, we had people provide things for us, and the things that we'd collected over a 20-year period of the family being together, and noticing, oh, we haven't got that. Or the children's trophies, they didn't have the memorabilia that they could, oh, you know, these achievements and things like that. Some pretty precious memories were probably the biggest deal. A few things that, you know, you enjoyed using in the kitchen, or, oh, we don't have that trailer anymore and we haven't got an outdoor setting, like, where we could entertain, because we love entertaining. So it sort of hit home that we've got to, you know, we got our immediate needs, but we're still in the process of recovering some of those things that we did enjoy.
What about the kids, Catherine? How's their recovery been?
Look, actually, the fallout for that was there was a couple of my children do now suffer from anxiety. Mind you, in their work situation, my son especially, he's doing really well. He's moving up the ladder, so to speak, and challenging himself in his job, and I'm really grateful that he's got that focus. But he does and has suffered from anxiety, which he's going to address medically shortly. Another child as well, is in the same position. But she is coming good. And the younger ones, they're very concerned about mum's safety.
Wow.
Like, we went to the beach for a weekend and, one of my little ones turned around and said, "Oh, Mum, can you swim well?" And I said, "Oh, not particularly." She said, "Well, you stay there and don't come out too far. I'm going to go with Daddy." And she was very concerned that I couldn't swim. I can swim. I'm sure I'll be fine. But I thought, wow, she's a little mum now.
Wow. You mentioned earlier in the conversation that there were some pleasant shocks that came after the fires. Share some of those with us.
You know, the people that stuck with us, that are still tapping in and, seeing how we're going in the progress. And, it actually dwindled quite a lot. I think when it was in the papers and it was there all the time, everybody was trying to be involved that could and gave whatever they could. And even if it was just an encouraging word, but once it went out of the papers, you felt dropped.
Yeah.
And I think that's when it hit really hard, because, even in the new home that we got for ourselves, it was like waking up in someone else's place. It didn't feel like your home. And even though it was decorated beautiful by lovely people, that did a lot of work. But there was a fallout there. Like, it was very difficult. I think it took me a fair few months before I actually felt like, oh, yes, I can live here now. So that was quite uncomfortable. Mm.
When we spoke after the fires last year, you mentioned that at times, sometimes God lets us endure lessons in life so that we become clearer in our understanding. In what ways have you become clearer in your understanding of life as a result of these fires?
I'm more God-centred. I felt like my relationship was starting all over again, actually. It can be like a bad marriage, really. You get so focused.
Yeah.
You can focus so much on your work and your activities that, God gets pushed aside, and corporately as well. So the God-centeredness is on well and truly on its way, and that's exciting.
Mm.
That's the exciting part. Wherever we were pushing him aside or just letting the life get in the way, we've made a conscious decision to make sure that doesn't happen again. And mind you, I don't believe we're being punished. Like, some people think we're being punished. We never ever saw it that way at all, and I know people wouldn't understand that. Things happen, and there's other people who knows where they're at in life, but at the end of the day, we never considered that, we're naughty people because, we're not actually doing what we're supposed to be doing in this area or that area. It wasn't like that. We know who God is, and he's a loving God, and, at the end of the day, it's only fit things.
Yeah.
And yes, there is pain involved. But life goes on. And you can rebuild, and it's an experience that's happened. Other people go through these things. I think it's made me aware of what people's needs are more now than ever. And I think that's a valuable gift, because I'll be able to support people in a more effective way myself. And I think all of us, our compassion has increased.
Yeah.
For people that have been traumatised through fires, floods, whatever. It doesn't even have to be a natural disaster. So in actual fact, the things that were already there just have increased and not decreased. And it's not out of, fear or anything like that. It's more meeting people's needs and giving, and that's our focus. Giving back to the community, yeah.
I get a sense, Catherine, this was very much a reset for you.
Yes, you're right. Absolutely reset. Reset, definitely. I actually knew a month before there was going to be a major change. I looked around the house and it was like, change has to happen.
Wow.
And I did. I was looking around the house. I'm like, there has to be change. Things aren't moving forward the way that we would have liked. I just didn't expect it like that. Yes. In saying that, I was really shocked, you know. And, you know, I emotionally, like, I've suffered disappointment too, you know. I think I'm going to be more mindful of, like, not making promises that I don't follow through on when people have been, you know. I think that we can learn a valuable lesson if you say you're going to do a certain thing, not to, because people are so vulnerable, not to just drop off the radar, so to speak, and not follow through on that. I think that was a lesson that was learnt by all of us. So, you know, and look, it's going to happen. It basically sorts out who your friends are and who your friends aren't.
Catherine, I don't know if you're the anniversary marking kind of girl, but what does today mean to you?
Today, our future is full of possibilities. And it's happened. It's a long way away now, you know. Like, yeah. It's not like it's encroaching on us to the point where, you know, our children have connected with other, just through their circumstances, other children from other schools. They are more thankful for where they've been put. They've been exposed to the wider community, and that's exactly what I wanted for them. And I was actually concerned that our world was a little bit too small. And, you know, I feel like I know everyone from Katoomba to Blacktown, yeah. all through Sydney, and it's very exciting. And actually another lady, she became a firefighter, completely inspired by the fires and, you know, and close to the family. And I was just so amazed. And she's being a role model and example to her own family. And it just really touched my heart that through the connection with me, because actually she was one of the ladies that also spoke to me that morning that it was happening, and I actually completely could not remember the conversation I had.
Wow.
She said, "Do you remember me ringing blah, blah?" I actually could not remember until she had to repeat what she said over and over, and my recall wasn't very good for about 4 months. So that must be just the effects of something like that. And I was a bit concerned. I'm thinking, I can't remember things. What's going on? But it's very normal, apparently. So lots of other people were in that boat as well. And, in fact, I think we fared fairly well in that situation. But so yeah, the wider community was affected by what happened to our family. And it's exciting because we have other families who are rebuilding up there and said, "Oh, the houses are going really cheap up here. Come back. And I would dearly love that, but we're not ready to yet.
Yeah.
So just, you know, financial and all that sort of thing. So, but I thought, yeah, I would in a heartbeat. So that was felt really nice.
Catherine Hubbard, thank you so much for sharing once again with us on Open House Around Australia, given yours was one of our first conversations after the fires of last year, and all the best to you and the family.
Thank you so much.
Even while the fires were still being extinguished from his community, local Blue Mountains muso Phil Davidson and Jake Norter, a former music student of his, were organising a fundraising song to aid the recovery effort. Here's the moment Phil realises fire is coming to town.
Well, I was sitting in a little classroom teaching some kids guitar on the lower mountains here in Warramoo, and I noticed as I looked out the door, as the kids were coming in, they had this incredibly windswept hair, and things were blowing across the playground, and I knew that the wind had turned, the weather had turned quite severe, and I didn't actually realise quite how severe it was until parents started to be racing into the school about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, picking the kids up early and taking them home.
Wow.
And I started to drive home, and I looked up from the driveway of the school as I headed up towards my home and just saw the sky explode. It was incredible, just full of black, thick plumes of horrific smoke and fire. It was dreadful, very frightening.
There's something that's never quite the same after a fire recedes and the flames are put out and perhaps even the rebuilding is finished.
Yeah, absolutely. I was lucky. It didn't affect me. It didn't hit my suburb. I live in the next suburb. But, you know, everybody that I speak to that was in that area when the fire went through, even now when they hear a siren, when they get a whiff of smoke in the afternoon, when, you know, anything, they see anything on the news related to fire or whatever, or they see something still burnt out, left at the side of the road that hasn't been removed, the chill just goes straight back through them, and it's an ongoing thing. Yeah, it's quite amazing, and that's a year on. I'm still really struggling with it.
So turning to the song then, Phil, Love That Matters, how did it get its start and why?
It actually started, believe it or not, with me standing on the roof of my house looking across the gully at the fire, watching the extent of it. And I saw as the fire swept through that the fire was going from just a normal grey, kind of browny grey, to thick, thick black plumes. And I knew that it had hit houses by that point. We didn't have a lot of feedback from the from anything else other than just what we could see. And I knew it was bad, and I just was terrified on my roof, thinking that somebody has to do something about this. And there's not really a lot of things I can do other than maybe write a song. I can't rebuild a house, and I can't do much. So I thought I'd use what I have as a songwriter and try and throw something together. So I sat down within the next day or two and just started to write down some of the things that I was hearing off the radio. And one of the things actually came, believe it or not, off the Open House program.
Believe it. It's a worthy program, Phil.
Well, you interviewed a lady called Catherine Hubbard. And
yes.
I was actually teaching her daughter guitar on the day that the fire hit.
Wow.
And she lost her guitar and lost everything in the blaze. And one of the things that came out of the interview from her and a lot of other people that I was listening to was, you know, we've been through this terrible thing, but we still have each other, and we still have our family, and we still have, you know, there's an incredible love in the community that's kind of holding us together and holding us up. And I thought, gosh, rather than just write a song about the disaster, I thought I'd write it from the perspective of having, you know, that it's, you know, when all these things are stripped away, it's love that matters. And that became the catchphrase for the song. And so it started from there. Yep.
Speaking of pupils, one of yours, Jake Norder, has joined you in the song. He's also a Blue Mountains resident. How did he fare in the firestorms?
He was pretty close as well. Yeah, he was just on the other side of Springwood when it hit. And he was also, his wife was expecting a baby around about that day. So it was all very hectic for him. And so he was trying to juggle being around close to home to protect his own house, but also to get together with me and try and nut out some of the finer details of the song. And yeah, even while he was down at the hospital, he was constantly trying to work out how he was going to get back and finish the song off with me. Yeah, it was a crazy time. It was bizarre. And look, we got it all together within a fortnight. We had the
song,
I think, pretty much on the air, recorded, produced, mastered, and on the air.
Yep, ABC, our friends down the road, gave it a bit of a spin, and yep. We love the song too here at Open House. Was it everything you wanted it to be?
Look, yes, because we wanted it to be of the moment. You know, we could have laboured long and hard and got everything perfect on it, and, you know, as you often do when you're producing a song. But this one, we were just caught up in the urgency, and with every second that kind of went by, we knew it was time where possibly the moment would pass, and we didn't want the moment to pass too quickly. We wanted people to grab the song, but also be caught up in the you know, all, everything else that was going on, so that it was valid and so that it had some impact when people heard it.
So here we are, 1 year on. The song's still available?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's available on all the download sites. Yeah, absolutely. And look, every cent from the song goes straight in to help the fire appeal in the Lower Mountains. So you know, it's a fantastic cause, and. People, we were so overwhelmed with the response last year that the song charted, basically went to number one the next day.
Yeah.
With the amount of people that bought the song and helped out, and that was fabulous. That was right across the country, so it was wonderful. Yes, and we hope that happens again this year, because, you know, there's just so much money needed. There are so many people still struggling even a year on. It's incredible.
I was going to ask you about your neighbours, both near and far, as lives have begun to be rebuilt. How are they coping today?
Yeah, look, I run into people all the time. Every time I play the song or talk to people in the mountains here, I get different stories from people. But look, a lot of them were underinsured for the fire. There's actually a clause in a lot of the insurance policies regarding the fire zone that they didn't realise. So a lot of people have actually lost a lot of money and don't have the money to rebuild their houses the way they were. That's been pretty horrific. We've lost something like $100 million in tourism dollars in the Lower Mountains, and something like 500 jobs because of the fires and people, you know, not wanting to come and see the mountains anymore. There are people who are still currently homeless. There are still people that are house-sitting for other people. There are people that have moved completely out of the area and have relocated to other areas because the fires are just, you know, so prevalent in their minds, so they just can't live there again. And there's people, and of course, you know, once the shock factor has died down, there's the reality of living life, you know, and all those pressures that come with not having a home and having kids and all those sort of things, you know, that are going on. So, yeah, it's very tough. It's very tough even still. But look, there are really encouraging stories of hope, and the local churches in our area have been fantastic in pulling together and helping.
If it's not already in your device, grab a copy of Love That Matters. The money's going to the right cause. And Phil Davidson, here's hoping and praying that it's a happy and safe summer for the people of the mountains.
Thanks, mate.
Here's a little taste test of Love That Matters. Phil Davidson.
I hear your voice coming down the line. It's love that
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.